Welcome to Creative Direction. This podcast was created to celebrate the courage it takes to become an entrepreneur. And we discover how working artists and creatives are making their way. As entrepreneurs, many of us had the desire, but not the roadmap. Creative Direction is meant to explore the diverse voices and approaches to working and making a living. It is our hope that this podcast helps provide some insights that might aid you on your own creative journey. I'm excited to welcome my co-host for this episode, Elijah Teague. He is also our producer and editor for Creative Direction. Welcome to Creative Direction. All right, today we have a very special edition of Creative Direction. We're welcoming Russell Lord to the podcast. Russell, in short, you're a creative director and designer living in Chicago. You've worked for Nike, Porsche. Is it pronounced Porsche? I don't know. I can never remember. you probably know. And the Special Olympics, to name a few. You also designed our logo for Creative Direction. I'm excited to have you here.
Oh, yeah. It's been super fun to actually work with you after knowing of you, but not working directly together.
We more than know of each other. We're actually friends and live near each other.
That's true. It's good for me to meet you, though. I've heard a lot about you.
Yeah. You do so much. I don't know how to describe you. You're a creative guy.
How do you summarize that? Question that you start with. I think that's kind of been one of my historically one of my bigger challenges, and lately, in recent years, I've kind of figured it out and just kind of simplified down to saying I'm a visual creative, and it starts with design and goes from there and extends in a number of different ways. But you need to pin yourself down a little bit for the benefit of other people at times. It's I do a lot of things, but I feel like that's something that, it was probably the most common young designer mistake that I made, was to get good at a bunch of tools, but then confuse that with the core discipline. So it really centers on design, really. But it's just fun to shoot off from there and animate it and do everything else.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about where you're at right now. You're at Havas, correct?
I'm at Havas. Most recently at 36 East Grand, and now at my house.
That global pandemic got you working from home a little bit? Is that
I miss work. I miss the office a lot, but it's been pretty cool to get back towards more of the freelance working lifestyle and bring that to big agency work. It's been fun.
How long have you been at Havas for?
Coming up on 2 years now.
Okay. It's fully remote right now, 100%.
Yeah, I wish we could get back in the studio. We have a great shooting room there and work with a lot of really gifted photographers there. And I miss that most of all. I have nothing like that.
What's your position there? Sorry.
So I'm senior art director.
Okay.
And
it's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, that sounds like a big deal.
It's really fun, and work on AutoZone. We just made new spots and going into more new spots. So Havas has been a big change, because being formerly doing agency freelance, you didn't really get the same opportunities to really get into depth with a client that you do when you're, in and every day for 2 years. And so it's really, really cool. A lot of people be like, oh, I'm bored after 2 years. Yeah. I don't know. They just keep serving up new challenges and things that are fun to dig into. So
that's cool. Yeah. And then let's take it all the way back. How did you freelanced, you've been in agencies, you've kind of switched back and forth. Give me the arc. What's the story? Tell me a little bit about the origins of Russell Lord.
So go back to, I think one of the exciting turning points early on in my career. The whole artistic and design impulse goes way, way back, but I feel like when everyone's a kid, they could be a designer, right? And then you have to look at it in hindsight and say, well, where was the turning point? And I guess I came to Chicago for a number of different reasons, but I hadn't really sorted out what my professional path was going to be. And I thought, oh man, I've been really getting into DJing, and I could take that, see how far it goes. And I've been really getting into creating art. I didn't have a computer or anything at the time. I was just physical art creation on the other side of it, but then working some like bad retail jobs or whatever, and kind of was like racing these two like side hustles against each other.
Which one's going to win, right?
Which one's going to win, right? And the art I had, I don't know, like not the level of like success right away that people were, you know, not really super getting stoked about my art. You know, self-expression is kind of a hard thing to sell. Depends on how you're feeling, right?
People like happy pictures, Russell, all right?
It was like struggle. It's just, you know, you want to buy a picture of struggle and hang it above your sofa? People are like, yeah, you know.
That's basement bathroom at best, right?
Yeah, so that was exactly basement bathroom, both. It's the bathroom in the basement. You have to open up the cabinet. It's inside the cabinet door. You know, I was doing music on the other hand, and the difficulty there was the drama of all the alcohol and the nightlife scene was like really wrecking the fun and expression and the joy of it. But I was kind of, I got hooked on making flyers for all the events and the jackets for mixtapes and for CDs that I would do a recording of myself and my friends and, you know, tag team sets, and we do live sessions and all kinds of stuff. And I realized that I wasn't doing the music for the music. I just wanted an excuse to like have another car design.
Be a creative director
and
for yourself.
Got a computer. I was like, I feel so good selling out with this little area of my life. I feel like it's making me happier to sell out and turn this into something commercial. Yeah. I don't want to keep it precious to me. And so that was like, okay, well, now I just need to find someone who'll pay me to do this all the time.
Yeah, but that's not really a sellout thing. That's like just following your nose, right? You know, you're doing one thing to do the other thing. And then you just cut out the like extra thing, you know? But you still spin and stuff on the side, but it's not main focus, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm like actively trying to not get gigs. If someone was like, you play out, I'd be like,
he's that no. good.
I will pay you to not play out. Here's $20 and a CD of me playing from 15 years ago. Let's call this over.
So you're looking for a job, essentially. I think that's where we left off. Like, how did you wander your way into advertising?
Yeah, and then, well, my brother worked for an architect at the time. And I don't know, someone came through his house and they were just having a conversation and my brother heard. It's like, oh, you're looking for a designer? Well, my older brother will help you out. And he just like put my name out there without saying, consulting me or anything. And I got a phone call from a stranger. He's like, your brother says you're good. He goes to the Art Institute, so you must be good. And I was like, I'll work my ass off. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, there you know, go.
Basically, like, I won't promise you I'm the best, but I'll work really hard and be honest. And you know, that was like good enough to get my foot in the door.
That's a pretty good set of values to start out with, right?
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, that's all anyone wants, really.
That's right.
Wait, so you were at the Art Institute, or your brother was at the Art Institute?
No, my brother went there. Okay. It was great because I didn't have to like pay the tuition.
Yeah, exactly. You got all the connections with that.
Yeah. Exactly. University of Wisconsin art history doesn't like really give you a direct line into anything except more art history at a different
was that direction you thought you wanted to go when you first applied?
No, it was film. So I did film for 2 years, but got frustrated with the department, but I loved all my art history classes. I had taken one survey class in high school, and then when I went to school, I was just taking it as fun electives, like breadth requirements.
Yeah.
Sitting in the dark, drinking huge coffees and looking at art and hearing the stories about all the weird people who are fascinating and make it.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's like this podcast, but it was live in a room with 450 people in a lecture, you know?
Yeah, and they were talking about dead gays, you know?
Mostly. Yeah, exactly. Pretty much always.
Cool. Well, that's cool. So you got a gig, and then you levied that, and...
I got a gig, and then I just kept taking opportunities and, you know, doing side jobs of my own, always like scrambling to make more work for myself. And I don't know, just like could never figure out anything better to do than come home from work and just like keep going.
Yeah, that's cool. That's awesome.
Yeah. I don't know.
Did that feel like you ever didn't have time for yourself, or was it kind of like just a moment where you're just really committed to kind of getting to that next level, but you felt like once you got there, you could kind of relax, or no relaxation in sight?
I mean, like, I don't know. I feel like, you know, this is one of those like real slippery slopes where I don't want it to go into an uninteresting corridor of like interview, but, yeah.
That's where editing comes in, man. We'll cut it out. We've already cut like half of this episode already.
Doing stuff is relaxing,
right?
So to be busy with one part of my mind is to be calm in the other part of my mind. So in the part of my mind that's critiquing my life, or you know, giving me stress about, man, I just, you know, whatever, my finances are completely out of whack, or you know, I don't feel like I have a friend in the world. Well, it's kind of like all those internal voices kind of just immediately shut off when I'm completely focused and immersed in a project. So it's kind of like the ultimate medicine for that. It's just creating and ignoring the rest of your problems in life and just using all that to channel back into like doing one thing instead. It's amazing what you can ignore. Like,
for sure.
Or just like, I mean, that's, I've been thinking about a lot about that lately. Do you think it's, to summarize it maybe a different way, do you think it's like replacing those unproductive activities with something productive? You know, like, I don't know, I have this weird thing where I do a lot of negotiation with myself, where I'm like, oh, should I buy this thing? Should I not buy this thing? Should I, you know, a little retail therapy, whatever it is, or, you know, even something as simple as like a cup of coffee, like I'll think about that. Oh man, can I really afford that $4.95? I don't really know. You know, like, but it's all like idle chatter, so I can avoid the things I actually need to be doing. And then lately I've been trying to replace it with like things that actually move me forward, like recording the podcast or...
Isn't it so much more gratifying at some point, like you hit a wall with Netflix and it's just like, okay, like I may haven't seen it, but I've seen so many things like it by inference that I've basically seen the basic view of the entire media universe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's the curve of enjoyment just completely falls away.
Like, yeah, maybe I should do my books.
Not that.
Never. Yeah, I still haven't done them yet. I need to get on that. So tell me about your agency life, man. I'm just, you know, a grubby little freelancer. I you know, run wild in the streets every day. Like, I don't, that's not true. But like, what is like a typical day for you normally, like in the before times or even now, you know, like what do you spend most of your day doing?
Yeah.
In that,
well, I guess, world? Yeah, to me, it's not a lot different from a successful freelance practice in a lot of ways, because first of all, when I was freelance, half of that time I was spending working at agencies anyways. Mm-hmm. So I was working with those types of teams, doing work in that similar type of structure and schedule. But on the other side of the same coin, I think that success in an agency really depends on the same sort of principles of ways of working as when you're freelance. Is, for example, you can't wait for a lot of answers.
Yeah.
You really need to make up the answers, learn how to communicate really well, you know, add value, be thoughtful about every word that you write in an email. So when it comes to the communication, it used to be client communication. Now it's communication with my own team.
Right.
You know, my client is my creative director at Havas, in the most important way. And so as he would like me to be working, it's alternation between trying to keep as much, you know, block time to focus stuff as much as possible, give it the focus it needs, and then just like crank out the rest and just get it out fast, get it off the plate. And so to kind of like always be like alternating between those two things and just, you know, I don't know. I think other people actually do a better job at being inspired, quote unquote, at work, and can like take their downtime better than I can, and just, you know, look at magazines or the internet or something like that. And I feel like I kind of need a change of scene for that. So I think in that way, I'm a little bit unusual. I don't know.
I mean, I think a lot of what you're talking about, and I kind of get in that flow too, where it's having that entrepreneurial mindset while you're working for someone else. Like, how do I, the things like you're talking about, how do I add value? How do I keep focused? How do I get this thing off my plate so I'm ready for the next thing that they're going to, you know, put at me? You know, like that's basically being a freelancer, but just going to the same office every day, you know, like that's pretty cool. I know you're pretty like a techie guy. We've been talking about your computer stuff and things like that and how you're leveraging technology to like work more efficiently, where you like, you're processing images, you're doing things that like normally maybe might be a little bit outside of the scope of what you do.
Sure.
In the interest of serving a little bit yourself, right? So that you don't have to back and forth, but also adding value to your clients again. Like, I mean, that's, talk about that. I mean, that's like, I guess I talked about it for you. I'm a terrible interviewer.
No, I think it's interesting though, because you do reach a point as in any given pursuit where you need to specialize, and not all of the things that I've kind of trained myself at, they don't all move forward into this job. And so some of the things like, oh, being a photo retoucher in the past as an early job, completely handy. Yes, 100%. Like sometimes there's just not time to send something over to a production artist and have them, you just like have to be able to do it. Yeah. And, you know, other things, not so much. But oddly enough, I think one of the really cool features of the agency life is that it's always a value to be able to like walk into a room with a sketchbook that has a few blank pages and a pencil. And just when you have an idea, save a million years of talking and putting it in a deck and just sketch it out in literally 15 seconds. And I think that's a really cool thing where I feel like, oh, if I worked in like a VFX environment as a, you know, or like I was an editor or I was a photographer, I guess I'd find ways of using sketching as a skill. But I feel like that's one of the real joys of being an art director. And I think that the people I work with, as they're also visual, who I'm communicating with, like content creators, photographers, creative directors, is so easy and fun to show them a picture, you know.
It's like your tribe, right? You know, they understand your language a little bit.
Mostly,
right? Yeah. I think that's for why we get along a lot, you know.
That's a definite thing of being like hooked on work, is when you realize that it aggregates, it's like a magnet for all these people who are like you.
Yeah.
In a way, and you just really like enjoy, especially I think if you're kind of like an outsider type person, in most of your life, people are being like weirdo, you know, all the time. and then you work in this environment, you walk in the door and you don't even look like a weirdo. You feel like maybe you're a little straight-laced, you know?
You're the most normal one.
You get the least amount of piercings and tattoos in your office.
Exactly. Probably not the least, but like close.
So. That's what happened when I started art school, so.
Yeah, right.
I understand.
That's great. It's
you're
great.
Like, I'm home. This is where
exactly.
I belong.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think you understand each other. That's really cool.
So for people that might not know what a creative director does, can you like give a little description for that? Like,
yeah.
Like if I were a Martian and you had explained to me how you make money after you, of course, explained what money was.
Well, like, right.
That's a complicated metaphor.
Correlates on a flexible scale to different geographically, it may be worth less some places than more others.
That's very good. That's well done. You've served humanity well.
What was the second question? What's a creative director?
What's a creative director even do?
So, you know, to be fair, I don't know. Like, I feel like I need to change some things to not say creative director because it's not my current job title. But I have done that job in the past, like on someone else's, you know, dime. And it was basically being the boss of people who were like the visual and the copywriter creatives, but also, you know, in my case, it was a digital agency. So there were web developers and stuff as well, and other types of content creation. And really it was a lot more new business related. And so I think interestingly, this maybe doesn't really answer your question, but the job at Spark Factor when I was creative director, I was initially asked to interview for an art director role.
Okay.
And the owner of that company had then found out that his creative director was leaving. I don't know if her title was officially senior art director or creative director, but I can't prove it, but I believe his realization was that I was worth more to his business with a bigger title, because by ascribing that to me,
and you deserve it,
his clients valued me more because I had the title.
That's a win for everyone, I think.
Yeah.
So I think that's interesting, but it does reveal something about the creative director role, which is how client-facing it is. It's really, really in the thick of it. And as an art director, I mean, there's certainly some client face to face, but I'm insulated from a lot of that and do just more of the hands-on work.
So the creative director is more like the creative project manager that deals with client facing. They're kind of the bridge between.
Wouldn't cross those two terms.
Yeah.
But he's the boss or she. He or she or they are the boss.
And the art director typically works under a creative director?
In an agency environment, yeah, absolutely. Okay. So, and that person also spans generally copy and art. So even if they came up through one discipline side, their purvey is now at a higher level and it's more concerned with the concept and kind of like both the real focus of the final product and the high level concept, you know, making sure that it kind of comes 360.
Yeah. So they're making sure everyone working on this ad campaign is getting it together and on target for all of the higher level thinking involved with the concept and all that stuff like that. They're driving all that. Cool.
Yep.
It's a complicated role. That's why we've had a little bit of problem to describing it. It's a big moving machine in an ad agency is, right? You know, there's a lot of parts.
It is. Things are a lot simpler when you're like trying to run a small business and you have two people working for you.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Like, but in some ways you don't have to take on so many responsibilities though, right? Like that's kind of the difference, is that you just kind of are allowed to.
I think the responsibilities are more It's really just the roles are, you know, the roles are just more like starkly divided.
Yeah, that's
true. Of all these different gradations, right? It's just kind of like, I don't know. It's a lot simpler in that way.
Yeah, it kind of is a never-ending balance, I see.
Yeah. I mean, Ross is the, you know, master of Chicago hustle. So, I mean, he knows what it's like to employ people and to be also, you know, it's like you're in the boss and at the same time you're on the hook for the final deliverable. So yeah. you're at like both ends of the hook as a small business owner. And it is a real relief. I really, really did not love that part of the freelance equation. So happy to have, you know, a CFO person somewhere in the office taking care of all the things that relate to that.
Yeah.
Benefit the person and all that stuff. Like that stuff is thankless. I'll take the client interface. I don't mind that so much 90% of the time, but all right.
I mean,
that is great most of the time. They're wonderful.
Yeah, that's actually my favorite part, but I'm a weirdo, so you know, whatever.
Talking to clients.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, their kind of hopes and dreams are like tied to yours. I mean, I deal with a lot of smaller businesses. I guess hopes and dreams are a little lofty, but their goals and like things they want are kind of tied. They believe in you. That's why they've hired you. So they're invested. You know, they want to talk to you. They want you there.
Yeah.
So usually that's a good relationship for me. That's what I appreciate doing. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh. I don't know who's calling me from Rhode Island, but it's probably no one again. We'll edit that out. Turn off all your phones. Whose phone is that? Turn off all your phones and devices. Such a dick. Hold on. Let me turn off my notifications. Like I should have done the first place.
That's cool. So I'm waiting for some I don't know. Some really hard-hitting questions that are really going to
hard-hitting questions.
Knock me in the stomach, kind of.
Let's bust.
I can't think of what it are, but like I feel like you're like.
Let's bust out the secret list, Elijah.
Secret list, yeah. I also feel like I might be able to be a little bit more articulate about. To be honest, like Havas is hard for me to talk about.
That's why I've been beating around the bush on that one because I don't want to.
It's right. It's like what I'm doing right now, and it's so much easier to talk about something that you've finished doing. So I apologize for that.
Well, because normally we'd ask you, you know, what do you have in the pipe? What's happening? And you can't talk about any of that stuff. But maybe we should talk about what you finished. What have you worked on recently that you can talk about?
Well, I've recently. Not finished something. That's pretty cool.
That's not what I asked you.
I did. Let's see. We finished spots. I finished selling some camera gear on eBay.
That's not a thing.
It's not this account?
No.
Everything's in progress.
Not unless you're actively selling it and you want to hawk it on here. I made pizza last night. So that was good. Oh, that's something true. I did. Now you go, Russell. What's
I finished a cocktail or two with the Democratic National Convention last night on TV.
That's great, but this is not a political podcast, so you're on your own there, buddy.
I didn't tell you if the cocktails were because I liked it or because I didn't.
It took a long time to set our metadata tags, so it was entrepreneurship. I'm not going back in there.
Not talking politics.
Don't get
it. Obviously, had a huge design team behind that, though.
I worked with my. Oh yeah, did you notice they have this? This is relevant. They ripped off the Star Trek logo and smacked it in the middle of the zero in a 20. It's a weird possible design faux pas. It's like a star on the side, but it's the Star Trek from like the Next Generation. Like Picard's gonna walk onto the convention stage at any second. You know,
oh yeah, that totally is a knockoff of it for sure. Like,
it is.
They probably just bought it on Fiverr. You know, like they're they didn't hire someone.
So,
no, I'm kidding. I know they did.
The political popular engine on both sides of the aisle has really gravitated on Gotham. I think it's Gotham Black, the heaviest weight of Gotham.
Yeah, they really like those thick fonts.
It doesn't matter if you're Democrat or Republican or whatever. I think that if you're Green Party, it's handwriting font, but
no pays attention to them anyway.
Exactly.
I think it goes into like the design of like banks and stuff where it just want to look sturdy and
trustworthy.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah, it's really interesting though. If you want to see the type trends of decade by decade forever, just look at political propaganda. And you know, there's money there often without taste, but the trend you will see.
Yeah.
You'll definitely get a snapshot.
And Obama was like the first one to actually do a logo.
That?
Obama was one of the first to do like actual logo, and that kind of made it a necessity for every other politician afterwards to kind of have a logo to accompany their campaign.
Yeah, Joe Biden got his hand-me-down, I think.
That was like Saul Sender from 37 Signals that designed that. So, or was the creative director, not the only designer, but you know, his name got on it. So
the boss, in case you weren't paying attention earlier, he was the boss.
I saw a really cool talk. I think one of those things that I miss most during this time that we're in is going out and like AIGA lectures and Art Institute lectures and Society of Typographic Arts and Chicago Museum of Design, like all these amazing institutions that bring people together. That's the big inspiration. And it's so cool because you don't get it somewhere else other than Chicago. You can read a magazine anywhere, but you know, go to the Art Institute and see Tony Fry talk about architecture. And then even though you're not an architect, just try to go home and not do something creative after that.
Yeah.
You know?
So you think that before Corona hit, that was kind of like your main source of inspiration, was just kind of going out to events and museums and stuff, and kind of physical activities was kind of your source of bringing inspiration?
Yeah, I mean, I think that actually comes back to more like the art history side. Also the design influences from, you know, events and music and stuff like that as well. Is going out and absorbing something in a physical reality, design, experiencing design in a context, and to see the document of something as a design in of itself. So like the great bookstore that they have at the Graham Foundation, you know, that's amazing. Ross, I went to see the Andy Warhol exhibit with you.
Yeah, that was great.
And yeah, that was like my second time seeing it.
Yeah.
It's so affordable. freelancers, you should go, but wait, you can't. That was really great. Things closed down. It was really, really.
It's open again. The Art Institute is open by appointment, if you remember.
Oh, really? Masks the whole time?
Yeah.
Yeah, that is cool. Things are definitely reopening slowly in the museum side of things. So I have not tried. I have not gone out. I'm just like being very, very strict.
Yeah. Did we met at a screening, actually. We met
Dieter Rams documentary at the Music Box Theater.
Yeah, that was cool.
That
guy is, for such a like strict German designer, he's kind of cheeky.
Yeah.
There's cheekiness and a darkness to the German sense of humor, for sure.
There's like there's a scene in that thing, and I don't know if we're getting in trouble to talk about this, but like there's a scene in that where he's like walking through this chair museum, and he's just talking trash about like all these like kind of gaudy, like new modern chairs. He's like, I don't know what that guy was thinking. I think it's like pointing to the marshmallow sofa, and he just kind of like under his breath in German is like, that guy was, I don't know what that guy was thinking.
I think they subtitled what he actually said, even though he like muttered it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I remember that. It was funny. There's no shortage of judgment. Like, you could be totally lighthearted, right? But I think
it's a conversation.
You don't capture too many of those moments for me on camera where I accidentally say something, but
I mean, we're going to exercise the deep fakes and like, just, we have enough footage. We can make you say anything we want. It's totally fine.
That's good. That's good. I want to give you enough footage for that. Yeah, you asked a question about what I finished recently, though. I didn't really, answer
not,
you at all.
The answer is nothing, apparently. The agency life.
It is. It's very busy. And summer is also kind of a time to get out. Like, I feel like that's an agency life trope that's kind of true, is that you get a little bit less. It slows down just a little bit after the 4th of July. And I can, like, sleeping is a hobby for me this time of year. It's nice. Last weekend, I slept like a champion. You feel like that's, yeah, I mean, finishing TV spots is huge.
Yeah, what's the process like that? I mean, how does that even start?
I mean, it started last, the spots that we produced in start of June, we started concepting late last fall, around like last Thanksgiving when we were originally briefed. And then there was some really big shakeups in the auto category that we had to adapt to, and we got rebriefed, which was like the most fingernails on a chalkboard thing in the world. So you know,
because you're like, you're all like full speed ahead, and then you're like, oh man, now we've got to stop and start, kind of maybe start over.
Well, I think this is like, okay, this is a relevant little detour in a cool way. I saw Michael Beirut talk.
Yeah.
And one of the few things that like will always stay with me was he said that designer's biggest challenge was getting past idea one. And he had this example of a museum in New York that he did identity for. And I think it's not fair to ask your friends because if they like your work, because they are biased to just say that they like it because they're your friends and not be honest with
you. Not me. I really grilled you on our logo.
No, you were really easy to work with. So it proves the point. But at the same time, like, I saw this design that he did, and it was obviously really, really great. The client saw something else, and it was a struggle to get past idea one. And I feel like that's one of those things where it's really transformative to think about your biggest job being to, like, have your first idea that's good and immediately put it aside and just do, like, different stuff. So when I did the Creative Direction podcast logo, I probably had 50 to 60 pencil sketches of different shapes and abstract ways to think about it. And, you know, just was doing those every night for a week after dinner, just sketch, 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 sketch. And the only important thing was that I was thinking about the concept and that what I executed was completely different. Go in a formal direction is different. If I'm using circles, use anything but circles after that. You know, if using all shapes, use things that aren't a shape after that. And just keep going and going and going and going. Then you walk away from it all. Kind of like the Don Draper process. You go really intense, walk away from it all, hope that the light bulb flips on. And, you know, you can't wait for the light bulb to flip on. So you have to walk away from it all and then just walk back. And I switched from pencil to computer. So there's all these restarts, and to like get in that rhythm of process and embrace the wasted time of the versions as something that has a value intrinsic to itself.
Yeah.
Process reveals value. And it's also like fun. Like, we did it without needing to before. So why wouldn't we do it with, you know, if we do it for fun, then that's when you get the good product. So, but to do that after doing 50 iterations of a TV spot, you know, and taking this feedback and moving and moving and moving and getting closer, and you've eliminated behind you, there's this like a wake spreading out from boat of all the ideas behind, all equal territory you cannot come back to in any way. You've just X'd out like 25% of the circle, and you know the 50% of it's already like not good to start with. And now you've got half the creative landscape that you had and the same assignment, but with another layer of difficulty on top of it, because this shift happened outside of your client's, you know, control. Oh, that was tough. But we ended up with, I think we did end up with something better, because always like more work does make it better.
Yeah. Right.
It's at some point you taper off into like the cost, the marginal return curve of it, but all work still does make it better. Even if it's only a little bit better for a lot more work, you're still going to make it better.
So was that insight during or after this happened?
These are multiple. I'm just like hopscotching from like multiple insights from different times.
I know, but it's probably hard to see that at the moment, right? You're like, ah, crap.
No, I think I was people down about it right away. And I think I said, leaving the conference room, I was like, it's going to be better the second time. Yeah. It's like, remember being in college and like losing your term paper?
You already wrote it. You might as well. You could probably do it pretty fast.
Second draft time. Is always right. Better.
Yeah. It's probably more concise because you don't want to deal with that shit.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Always better. It's better if you lose the initial thing completely and have to start over from memory, because you'll only remember what's important.
Yeah.
Don't look back at anything. Just like, yeah, I don't know, to me. I've gone off that's a satisfying, I think, like, thing to want to talk about is kind of that process, because it's such a painful thing to go through. And then when you like figure out a few things about it, it's like, oh, wow, my life is so much like more relaxed now.
Yeah, because you're going to figure it out. You have to, right? That's your job.
Or you go on to do something else and it's not designed. If you don't like getting sent back to the starting line, you know, if you don't like going back to the starting line, do not go into advertising. Do not go into design, because that's all it is about.
Don't be a photographer either.
So, I mean, Elijah, your dad is a designer.
Yeah.
You're a designer. Yes. How much of what I'm saying rings true versus bullshit?
Very true. I mean, first of all, with the iterations, I'm curious to how you kind of developed that process, because that's like something that my teachers just drill into us. So I'm curious how, without going to school, kind of how you learned that. And like, it's just like post-it notes after post-it notes of just ideas and just laying out as much as you can, just kind of like throwing up your brain onto a page and then coming back next day, picking out what's important. Next day, picking out what's important from that. So just constantly like throwing everything out, basically, is so true. And then especially when you have a teacher that you have to like get approval from every week, and then they tell you, I think you need to redo this. It's just, you get really used to it. So that's very true. And with my dad, it's like, it's a little harder, because when he makes something, it's like, two month long process that he has to then restart if it doesn't work out. So he has to put a lot more planning into it now at this stage, but I definitely see it just like at every stage as a designer, you have to deal with this constant fight. Yeah.
I will say that I benefited a lot from when I moved to Chicago. My brother still had 2 years left at the Art Institute. Mm-hmm. He was in the interior architecture program there. Undergrad. So he lived like less than a mile from me in Uptown, and I would go over and hang out, and we would do like sketchbook for like hours at a time and do collage together. We would just sit on the hardwood floor like doing stuff, and he would tell me about his classes and his professors and all this stuff. And so I really had the huge benefit of having a brother who went to the Art Institute, because you know, he told me about this, like, he's like, oh, process is product. And I'm like, okay, that took me 6 years after hearing it for it to really register. Like, if you think about it in building a house, it makes total sense. The process, you can't get the product without the process that goes into it. You change your process, the product changes. They're intrinsically linked. It's not that it literally is the same thing, but the two are inseparable. They're in a dualistic relationship.
So,
you know, so it's like, okay, I owe that entirely to Trevor. And then commercially, you just get punished by it. And the reality of everything that's true gets retaught to you again by having a commercial practice until you finally learn it. Like, the longer you choose not to learn it, the longer it will haunt you. The longer you ignore the good advice people give you, the longer you have to suffer with hearing that advice, you know?
Yeah.
Like, take the advice, you'll find out if it's good advice. Don't take it, expect nothing to change, you know?
Yeah.
How long do you want to feel pain is the real question, right?
Yeah. Angry at your client, design them a better logo faster with less rounds so you don't have to deal with them. Like, be a better designer for a worse client sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then never work with them again. But in the short term, you just have to kick ass just to get your way out of that, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The only way forward is through work, always, no matter what it is, whether you're working in-house or for working through a recession or a pandemic or whatever. The only way forward is to work.
Yeah, you still want to work on what you want to work on,
though. Right. Well, yeah. I mean, I'm working on a podcast talking to my friends.
Exactly.
That's my way forward, you know? Like, and it's work, you know, but it's – oh, I was just doing most of the work, but it's the work, you know? Like, you – yeah, but it's the good work, you know?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Do you feel like since you started working at Havas that you have less time to work on your own projects?
Oh, totally.
And does that trouble you?
Here come the hard questions.
This is like a really, I think you asked a really revealing question. Because this is not unique to working where I work now, and it's every job ever,
right.
And right. Freelance. It's like, if I'm busy, and even if the work doesn't go into my portfolio now, because I'm not looking for a job, and honestly, I'm not like trying to spend the time to update my portfolio, but you know, but if it's like portfolio quality work,
right.
And I feel really proud of what I'm doing, and I think, oh yeah, well, 10 years from now, when that's safely in the past, I would love to put a, you know, write up a, you know, portfolio post on this thing that I worked for AutoZone at Havas. Like, I completely want to show the world that I was part of that team and like, yeah, put my name right there next to AutoZone, because mm-hmm. I think that the work that we did is really, really good. Then it doesn't bother me that I'm not doing personal projects very much at all. I can completely live without doing side projects when that's happening, because when you own a home that's 120 years old, you know, and you like to
get like you're still building
friends and go on bike rides, there's other things to take up time.
Right,
but it's having that thing that you can hang your hat and kind of like go to bed at night and go, I worked on a great idea, and I make new ideas every day, and then I turn them into reality, you know, mm-hmm. And I watch these little, you know, cherubs of ideas come out and fly off into the world in all these different directions, and, you know, like the people I work with, and making cool things from imagination into real, where other people experience it, and that's just like so fun that it's totally addictive on its own. It's like, yeah. I have to have like strong emotional feelings before I want to do like a side project. Now it's got to be because I'm like really upset about something, like people coming to work sick and coughing on you. And I feel like, you know, I think it was March 2nd. I posted something on Instagram. It's a drawing of like a real phlegmy cough, just like gobs flying off the person's hand, you know? And it's like, maybe you should stay home, you know, written in sloppy marker ink, you know? Because, yeah, they get, or, you know, like, draw little expressive faces or things that have no commercial value. I'll just still do these, but they're, like, so fast and small and rapid fire that that they don't really count. Like, the Manhattan Project stuff, when Ross, I think, met me at the end of Manhattan Project times, having this interdisciplinary creative group come to the backyard and drink Manhattans around a bonfire in the yard in the like cold, shitty half of the year.
It was good. It was good times.
Yeah. Would do these little drawings and stuff. They don't even connect and make a campaign. I don't think there's anywhere to house them. But it was fun to do them, and then that got me, like, doing it, pushed me formally, and then I developed a style of doing the inky loose drawings that, you know, like, kind of actually are popular now, and the inky, like, big brush type stuff that's, like, popular, and I was doing it, like, 3 years ago because I was, like, looking for a way to not use my computer. So, like, also, like, the side projects that I do are mostly oriented around not being on the computer at all. Yeah. 90% of the side project here or on a piece of paper, and then it's like fun.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
No computer.
Yeah, I have your calendar is one of my favorite things.
Yeah, and I love that.
Was all. I wasted like a month in the basement doing the last calendar. I was doing all these drawings with marker on transparency. Because I'm scanning them and blowing them up huge. So I'm just, I'm not trying to create, I'm trying to create completely on acetate. And I must have done 50 or 60 sheets of acetates. And they've been piling up for like a couple weeks. And I took them upstairs to scan them. And as I start to bend them, I could just see that from all the static and from all the dryness, all the ink is just flaking off. And it's just flaking into pieces like the dust bowl, like the earth blowing away. And I was just like, no, there goes all my work. I had to be like, I tried to salvage like two or three, and I had to pitch them all and do them all again.
You say the process is the product, or what was that?
Oh, man, get those digs, Elijah.
It is. Oh, my God.
So for people that don't know about the calendar, can you talk about what it is and what it's kind of challenging a little bit?
Yeah, right. Do you want to hear the origin story or not?
We can. Yeah,
definitely.
That's why we're here, man.
Yeah, right. So the origin story is that, you know, Massimo Vignelli, I had learned about him as a famous designer, and that he made this trademark iconic calendar that's 36 by 48 inches, and you can get it at Crate and Barrel or Luminaire store. It's called the Stendig calendar, and it's all Helvetica, and the months alternate black and white, which one's background and which one's foreground. And I bought that for maybe about 12 years that I had that calendar up. And then 1 year, I like missed the cutoff date because they only make so many.
Yeah,
so they sell out by like October, and I'm always late. So I didn't make the deadline to get one because it's not published either. You just, you know, and I went on eBay and people were selling. They had like hoarded them and they were selling a $40 calendar online for like $350.
Holy fuck.
Yeah. So I'm contemplating the idea of doing this. And I think about the fact that kind of like from a modes of production, like a Marxism standpoint, I'm like, I have the modes of production, the means of production. I can make a calendar for less than someone's trying to fleece me for it. And I can just go to my commercial printer that I use all the time, and they love me because they bring them work and they'll probably give me a deal. And they did. So I like made one with no concept. It was a type specimen, but it was fun. And then I just thought, oh, I'm just gonna, okay, well, Vignelli did his thing, and it's the perfect calendar because it never needs to be redesigned. But then I was just like challenging. I thought, well, if he's the best designer, that, you know, the most people agree that Massimo Vignelli was the best at modern design. Mm-hmm. I'm just gonna challenge myself and go, okay, the best calendar might be the one that gets completely redesigned every year. And it's never the same. It just always like puts itself through the ringer and like takes a different approach to like how it interacts with time. So not to be like the same type of a theme thing, but to just push myself and say, you know, too, then if I had a year that went by and I didn't have anything that went on the record as like an amazing project, in the calendar every year and spend months and months working on it. And so for like many years, that was like the only, yeah, it would be like the only thing I did. But it's so hard, but I just can't stop doing it.
I don't want to stop
every year.
It's my favorite thing.
It's really hard not to stop.
This year was like a bunch of beautiful hand-drawn ink drawings again that are just like, what, each month is, you know, a specific drawing. It's really large. And I love that your time is almost an afterthought, but not really, because you think of everything. But like it's the actual days are at the bottom and they're really small. And it's all about having this piece of art that's in your living room or wherever it is in your house.
Well, I mean, that's an intentional thing too. And it's kind of fun. Like, I did it with this idea in mind that why is it like, it's so annoying when an event goes across a weekend.
Yeah.
And it's like on one end of the calendar and then the other. So like, Monday and Sunday and Saturday are really close to each other, but why are they far apart on a calendar?
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what side of the week you push it to. So I was like, time is a more continuous experience. And I want to do this thing and designed it. And then a couple of years later, I saw this John Massey book that I got at the Chicago Museum of Design. And he actually did a calendar for Great Container Corporation of America.
Yeah.
And had a linear date band on that as well. So it was not a nick, but
it's cool.
I always think it's cool that John Massey thought of it too. I'm like, I'm not the only one who thinks it's an okay idea.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. Idea. Good. Well, that's cool, man. Well, thank you for joining us for Creative Direction. It was really nice having you. I'm glad we touched on a whole bunch of subjects. You know, who's the boss was like a major one, I think. Apparently it's you.
Monty the cat is the boss.
Yeah, Penny the dog is the boss over here.
Exactly.
So, but yeah, it was really great talking to you, Russell. And thanks for shedding a little light about what you do and how our logo came to be. You know, it's really, really great having you.
Yeah, I would like to continue to push the logo design with you, Elijah. So
yeah, sounds good.
Put that on your calendar.
I'll put it on your calendar.
Let's animate it.
Yeah, I really want to animate it 1,000 times.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Cool.
Sounds great. Well, thanks, guys. Thanks for being on our episode of Creative Direction. This podcast is sponsored by Clever Editing. The difference between good content and great content is a little clever editing. Get a quote today at cleverediting.com.